Foxconn's development in Racine County got the go-ahead in 2017 as part of a deal that offered the company more than $4 billion in state and local tax incentives. It's one of the most high-profile, but definitely not the only example of private companies getting public incentives to relocate, or in some cases, stay where they are. Our next guest says more often than not, those packages don't pay off. But he thinks there are ways leaders can offer incentives that let more people share in the benefits of new businesses. Timothy Bardick is a senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute. He's the author of the book, Making Sense of Incentives, Taming Business Incentives to Promote Prosperity. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Why do you say that in most cases, business incentives don't pay off for the community paying them?
Well, incentives do lower costs some for businesses, but there are a lot of other costs. Incentives, the average incentive amounts to about 3% of wages. So even modest changes in worker productivity or the quality of local infrastructure can easily make a difference. And so in many cases, you're offering incentives to a company, it would have made the same decision anyway. In other cases, maybe that company would have gone away. Maybe they really want incentives, but some other company might have chosen the same parcel of land you're trying to market.
One thing you focus on is the idea of multiplier. The person making the case for an incentive might say, okay, yeah, we're putting a lot of money in, and the company itself will generate this money, but X amount of times of that are going to spill over in, you know, the businesses that supply this and in real estate and this and that. You say we need to look more closely at that so-called multiplier effect.
Well, multipliers are definitely real. I mean, you bring in a company, it will buy from local suppliers, the workers go out and buy from local retailers. That's true. But it's also true that when you bring in a company, it drives up local costs, land costs, housing costs, wage costs, et cetera. So that's going to discourage other business growth. A lot of times, the multipliers that are cited by state economic development agencies don't take account of these negative cost feedbacks. When you take account of those negative cost feedbacks, the actual net multiplier is reduced by about a third. I mean, if someone claims the multiplier is 3, that if for every one job you get 2 additional jobs, the true number might be for every one job you get 1 additional job, 2.
Here in Wisconsin, when we think of business incentive, we probably think of the Foxconn deal. We've talked to you about this before, but can you remind us how the Foxconn investment from state and local governments stacks up compared to other incentives around the country?
It's about 10 times the average in the country. I mean, as I said, the average incentive is equivalent to essentially subsidizing wages by 3% for 20 years. With the Foxconn deal, the original offer, was essentially equivalent to subsidizing wages by about 30% over 20 years, 10 times the usual thing, which you know led to, frankly, a lot of the national attention to this. A lot of policy people around the country said, look, if someone like Foxconn becomes general, this is what every state does to attract business, incentives would end up costing $500 billion a year nationally, which is about 30% of state and local tax revenue, which would have a major impact on the ability of state and local governments to provide public services. So I think people were kind of freaked out by the notion that Foxconn might lead to a real burden on the ability of state and local governments to provide adequate public services.
Talking to Timothy Bardick, senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute and author of the book Making Sense of Incentives, Taming Business Incentives to Promote Prosperity. He's talking about the use and misuse of incentives to either bring businesses into a community or to get them to stay there. But, Tim, you say there is a better way. What's a more effective way to use an incentive at the local or state level?
Well, I think if you limit the amount of the incentive, so you're not, breaking the bank, and if you combine that with services that I think are more cost-effective in boosting jobs, that package will work better. So, for example, I like what Virginia did to attract Amazon. They offered incentives that are equivalent to essentially saying to Amazon, for each job you create, we'll make you a one-time payment of $20,000 per job. And that's lower than typical incentives in the U.S. and much lower than Foxconn, which is over $200,000 per job. But then, actually, the bigger part of their package, they said to Amazon, we are going to locate a new campus at Virginia Tech in Northern Virginia. We're going to upgrade our computer science curricula across the state at the state colleges. We're going to upgrade the metro transit services and the highways. And that actually what they devoted the money to, not so much the cash incentives, which I think I'm sure Amazon liked. But this way, Amazon has some assurance they're going to have adequate transportation infrastructure to support the project. They'll be able to get the skilled workers they need. And Virginia also knows that a higher percentage of those jobs will go to state residents. And that's the bottom line. We're not trying to just have growth for the sake of growth. We're trying to create job opportunities for state residents, and we need to focus more of our attention on how to structure these programs so they do that.
And how about making sure that incentives create business where people need jobs?
Right. Well, we also need to target distressed areas. Now, that Virginia didn't really do that with the Amazon thing, but we need to target distressed areas. And some states try to do that. So, for example, North Carolina has tiers of incentives. They divide their counties up into groups. And, you know, the Research Triangle gets very, very low incentives, or Charlotte, North Carolina, because those areas are doing relatively well. But some of the rural areas of North Carolina that do not have high employment rates and have a lot of poverty and really need jobs, they get a higher incentive per job. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because if you think about it, incentives, if there's more non-employed people who are looking for jobs in an area, then more of the jobs are going to go to people who really need them. If you have an area that already has a low unemployment rate, all the incentive really does is create jobs and lead to in-migration. And while that's necessarily bad, it doesn't necessarily result in an improved employment-to-population ratio, improved employment rate for state residents.
How about the timing of incentives, upfront versus long-term, step-by-step scaled incentives?
Well, I preferred upfront incentives for two reasons. One, I mean, there's a lot of evidence that companies are myopic, that, you know, providing a tax credit that only pays off 15 years from now, why does the company care? They're not going to even be around, the executive who makes decisions is not even be around 15 years from now. But they're very focused on the stock market today. The other aspect is it's too tempting for governors and mayors to do that. I mean, if you're providing incentive 10 years from now, I mean, it's very tempting to do that because you get the political credit for offering the incentive now, and the next governor or mayor will have to deal with the fiscal consequences. So I think it's too tempting to governors or mayors to get the political benefits now and postpone the cost to the successors. I think you have a much better system where if you're the governor or mayor who's claiming credit for the project, then within your term of office, you're going to have to deal with some of the incentive costs, whatever they are.
In our last few moments, you mentioned a couple positive examples. Are there places where you'd say to a new governor or a new mayor or whatever, city planner, hey, go here, study what they do. They're getting this incentive business right.
Well, I like what Virginia did with Amazon. They have limited incentives. It's a one-time incentive. They have other things. They do customized training. Michigan does customized training. The Carolinas in general do customized job training, which has been shown to be very effective. Both, I mean, companies value knowing. Customized training is where the local community college helps train workers for the business. And that's a great incentive. Companies really value it. And it also helps make sure that more of the jobs go to local residents, which is what we should be trying to maximize.
And then we just have a few moments left. Do you see Amazon and Foxconn deals blowing the roof off here? Are we going to see more mega deals like this?
Well, I think it's up in the air. It depends on how the media, the political system, the public reacts to this. There was some blowback on the Foxconn deal. There was obviously a lot of blowback on the Amazon deal. The thing in New York fell apart. So I think it's up in the air. I mean, you still see states talking about big offers. On the other hand, you see Kansas and Missouri recently agreed to have more of a truce in their incentive wars. They've been regularly having companies go back and forth across the border between in the Kansas City area, bidding. You know, it's kind of a pointless thing. I mean, but, so there has been some progress. I do think that in some states, political forces are leading to somewhat more sane approach to incentives. Let's use them, but use them in a moderate way and combine them with other things that will target more jobs for your local population.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Tim Bartik, senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute. He's the author of Making Sense of Incentives. He joined us to look at why business incentives often don't pay off for the states and communities that use them.